and welcome to this month's edition of the American Journal of Gastroenterology podcast. This is Millie Long, co-editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Gastroenterology, and I am very pleased to introduce my guest today, Dr. Frank Foray, who is professor of medicine and director of the IBD Center at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. Frank, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Millie, for having me.
Well, we're thrilled you're here because the main reason you are here is to talk about a brand new guideline that we have out just this month in Red Journal on prevention in IBD. And I know this is an area that both you and I feel is of utmost importance to our patients. And so congratulations on this endeavor of updating this guideline.
Thank you so much. The last guideline was published in 2017, and so much new has happened over the ensuing years in the journal, as well as the authors felt that this was an appropriate time to update the guideline.
Let's jump in, because some of our listeners may want to better understand kind of the rationale for us as gastroenterologists focusing on preventive health recommendations. Can you talk us through that rationale and what kind of the guideline covers overall?
Absolutely. So you have to first realize that a young 25-year-old with ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease probably doesn't see their primary care provider as much as they see us. They perceive us, in fact, as the primary care provider. So it's important to make it clear early on in that relationship, your role and the importance of the primary care provider. There have been so many advances, however, in the treatment of IBD that we can't expect the primary care provider to know all the nuances. And so for the last several years, we've been advocating that the provider who's prescribing immunomodulating drugs take responsibility and kind of put on their internal medicine hat to try to make sure the patients get appropriate preventative care.
And what are the categories that you all cover in the guideline?
The biggest part is vaccines, and we'll spend some time during this podcast going over the new recommendations. We have new vaccines and new ages for old vaccines to administer. The second part is to go over a number of different other screenings. So we talk about screening for cervical cancer, screening for skin cancer, screening for osteoporosis. We want to recommend that all patients, regardless of whether they have ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, stop smoking. So these are some of the other things. Now, we don't cover colon cancer in this because I think gastroenterologists have a pretty good handle on the management of colon cancer screening in patients with IBD.
No, I agree. I think these other areas are where we need this updated guidance to help to drive our interactions with patients. So you mentioned that this was an update from a prior guideline that was well needed. Talk us through some of those really important changes since the last guideline.
The first we'll talk about is pneumococcal vaccine. In the past, we had several different vaccines, and life has become so much simpler. The new recommendations are that you could administer a single vaccine, either PCV20 or PCV21, and not have to worry about other vaccines. And so that one and done makes it a lot easier for us to immunize patients against pneumococcal diseases, which is one of the most common causes for hospitalization in terms of pneumonia. Now, in the past, that was recommended for individuals who were older. The new recommendations that came out in the last year from the ACIP is that anyone 50 and older, regardless of their immune status, receive the pneumococcal vaccine. For our patients that we see with inflammatory bowel disease, the ACIP recommends anyone 19 to 49, they would be eligible. So our patients that are on any type of therapy that is going to affect their immune system are eligible. And in fact, because patients with IBD already have an abnormal immune response and are at increased risk of developing pneumonia, you published papers on this back in 2011, I believe, or 2012, on the increased risk of pneumonia in patients with IBD. We're now offering the vaccine to all our patients who are 19 and older, actually. So that's one of the big ones. Now, the next one is the shingles vaccine. The shingles vaccine is an inactive vaccine, so all patients can receive it. Anyone above the age of 50 is now recommended to receive that, so whether they have IBD or not, and whether they're immunocompromised or not. But the ACIP several years ago really did us a big favor by also now recommending the shingles vaccine for anyone 19 to 49 if they're immunocompromised or if they're at risk for developing immunocompromised state. So again, all our IBD patients meet that criteria. And because some of the therapies that we use do increase the risk of developing shingles, the JAK inhibitors do that, the thiopurines do that, we're now recommending the shingles vaccine for all patients 19 to 49. And obviously, there's an issue if they go to their CVS or their local pharmacy where they might not meet the criteria of 50 and above. In situations like that, we write a note. And I know that the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation is putting together patient letters so that you can actually download and send them with your patient to the local CVS or their local pharmacy to receive the vaccine. That vaccine is two doses. It's typically given zero and then 2 to 6 months later. But if you do have a patient, for example, starting a JAK or on a JAK, by definition, they're immunocompromised, and you can shorten that interval. Give the first dose at day zero, and don't wait 2 months. Give the second dose 1 month later.
No, that's great. That was actually one of the questions I was going to ask, just because I get that not infrequently from other providers who are starting a JAK, worried that, do I need to wait until they're done with the whole vaccine, you know, one and two, before I start the therapy? And quite clearly, your answer is no, correct? You just need to do it concurrent.
That is correct. In fact, we published some data showing a 60% reduction in the risk of developing shingles in patients with IBD who receive vaccination. So right off the bat, we know that it's a highly effective vaccine. And so it's one that we really need to encourage. Now, a new vaccine that we never even mentioned back in 2017 is the RSV vaccine, respiratory syncytial virus. You might think, I've never seen a case of RSV. Well, that's because we invariably never tested for it. We tested for patients prior to COVID who presented with an upper respiratory tract infection, tested for them for influenza A and B. Then COVID came along, and now people got influenza A, B, and COVID. And now, most recently, at least at Mayo Clinic, if you present with an upper respiratory tract infection, you have a PCR test for influenza, RSV, and COVID. And so you're going to see more and more episodes or more and more diagnoses of RSV. In fact, it's probably just as common, if not more common, than influenza. And we know that patients with IBD have an increased risk of being hospitalized for RSV infection. So the recommendations right now are anyone 75 and older, regardless of their immune status, can receive the vaccine. And the newest recommendations are 50 to 74 if you're immunocompromised. So that's on my list, especially for my patients on thiopurines, steroids, and some of the advanced therapies. Again, there is only so much time in the day. There's only so much time with your office visit, so you need to prioritize. And so my number one priorities are pneumococcal vaccine and shingles. And then when they come back a couple months later, we can certainly get them to do their RSV. And then in the fall, of course, we are recommending influenza vaccine for everyone. Depends on their age, whether they get high dose influenza vaccine, 65 and older. And then despite the vaccine fatigue, we are recommending COVID vaccine. Follow the ACIP recommendations. Those are changing, but we do think that our patients with IBD would benefit from getting a COVID vaccine in the fall as the new strains become widespread. We are still seeing patients with long COVID. We are still seeing patients being admitted to the hospital with COVID if they're immunocompromised. So we can't let that fall by the wayside.
I completely agree, Frank. I did want to point out, too, only because soon the new pregnancy consensus statement will be coming out in Red Journal as well. The RSV vaccine you mentioned is also recommended during respiratory season and third trimester of pregnancy for moms, and RIBD patients can receive that. And frankly, then the infants at birth will have some immunity, some antibodies from mom. So another indication for RSV vaccine.
And then the other one that I'm actually very excited about seeing this pregnancy paper. We've been talking about it for the last year, and I understand the challenges of having to be published in multiple different journals. But we also talk about rotavirus. We now have very good evidence that the rotavirus vaccine, which is given to infants typically at 12 weeks, 8 to 12 weeks. There was some concern that if moms were on advanced therapies, for example, infliximab, there might be a concern giving a live vaccine, the RSV vaccine. But now it's become very clear based on studies that were done, very nicely done studies, that we can now actually administer that vaccine to those infants to protect them against a common cause of diarrhea.
Absolutely. It makes it a lot easier when you're counseling a mom in the U.S. that every vaccine can be given on schedule now. The new pregnancy consensus based on the Canadian Immunization Network data really do show that it's safe to give infants rotavirus vaccine if they've been exposed to a biologic in utero. So again, I think it will really help. The one live vaccine we still don't recommend is BCG vaccine, which is not given in a standard schedule in the U.S. So again, I think a really pro message surrounding the benefits of these vaccines for our patients and frankly, obviously for their children as well. One of the questions I had for you, Frank, in regards to vaccines, thank you for outlining kind of those new updates. That's a lot. But one of the things I also found useful was you did kind of outline a strategy for certain patients who may be eligible to hold therapies and provide kind of live virus vaccines. I wanted to ask you about that, in that in my practice, I find that it's hard for people, me, to really be able to stop therapy. And so in your opinion, is that the majority or the minority of patients that we may be able to hold therapy and provide live vaccines for?
So I think we could avoid the problem altogether that early on in our contacts with the patients that we assess their varicella status, for example, we assess their measles, mumps, rubella status, so that we're not in a situation where someone's on an advanced therapy and you find out that they've never been exposed to chickenpox, for example. So the reality is my practice is like your practice. If you had to stop an advanced therapy like infliximab, we're talking about holding it for 2 months, giving the vaccines, for example, varicella is 2 doses, 1 month apart. So therefore you're holding it for 2 months. You're then giving the 2 doses. So now you're basically 3 months, and then you have to hold it even further. It's not realistic to do that. Now, obviously, part of the issue is we're now facing a measles.
Right. And the big one.
States, and I'm sure you're getting phone calls from your patients. What should I do? Now, the reality is if your patients have received the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, they receive the course, then they're protected. I don't bother checking serology. But the reality is we should be able to avoid this because the majority of patients we can't stop. Now, for the drugs that have a shorter half-life, hypothetically, a JAK inhibitor, you can potentially hold that for 2 to 3 weeks, give a live vaccine, wait another month or so and restart it. We don't have the immunogenicity that we have, for example, in JAKs. But the reality is that if patients are on that therapy, they're on that therapy because they may have failed other therapies and they're finally in remission. And we just have to take the reality that it may not be practical. One of the things that is important that I stress to providers is something called the cocoon strategy. The cocoon strategy is make sure that everyone who's going to come in contact with an immunocompromised patient has been brought up to date on all their vaccines so that they will not inadvertently bring an infection into the family. I'm happy to say that I'm a proud grandparent for the first time, and my daughter made it very clear that if I did not get my pertussis vaccine, I was not going to see my grandchild. So that cocoon strategy worked for me. I think it is important that we work for all our patients to keep them safe by making sure all the individuals around them are appropriately vaccinated.
I love that. I'm going to steal it, Frank, the cocoon strategy. I like that a lot. Well, let's shift gears and talk a little bit about skin cancer. You mentioned that at the beginning as one area these guidelines cover. Can you describe what the updated recommendations are for skin cancer prevention and screening?
So we know that patients with Crohn's disease, independent of any treatment they receive, are at increased risk of developing melanoma. So the recommendations from the guideline, and again, some of them are key concepts and some are recommendations. And I'll be honest with you, most of the recommendations were conditional based on low evidence or very low evidence. But our recommendations were that in patients with inflammatory bowel disease, both ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, that they be evaluated for melanoma, and that's independent of the risk of biologic therapy. I send all my patients to see a dermatologist. I'm not going to demand that they be evaluated every year. I want the dermatologist to use the input based on their skin complexion, based on previous sunburns to make the decision, but I want to get them in to at least see the dermatologist. We also know that the thiopurines, the JAK inhibitors, and the S1P agents are associated with an increased risk of non-melanoma skin cancer. And for that reason, we also recommend they see a dermatologist and then let the dermatologist decide the actual interval of surveillance.
No, I think that makes sense. And I agree with you, Frank. I just want to get them in there and have them set an interval. I'm not going to mandate it because I think that can be individualized. And frankly, it's hard to get an appointment with a dermatologist these days, at least in North Carolina.
Especially in Florida.
Yeah, I'm sure that's even more so for you. So one last question before we wrap things up. I think that sometimes providers struggle with not only what to recommend, you've helped us a lot with that, but can you give us some advice on who should be recommending this? When? Are there certain visits where you stress this more? And are there other resources that we can provide our patients with so that they can be having these conversations with their primary care provider?
I'm the first to kind of point out that it's not practical to do all these on that first visit. So set priorities when you see patients, even if they have mild ulcerative colitis and they seem to be responding to mesalamine, check their QuantiFERON, check their hepatitis A, B, and serology. Start the discussion about the importance of vaccination. I point out that I'm up to date on all my vaccine-preventable diseases because we know there's lots of misinformation out there. Now, I'm blessed to have a large group of nurse practitioners and physician assistants that work with me. And so we alternate visits. And if we can't get to everything in the first visit or two, the nurse practitioners are making sure that we've done this. We also have access to a PharmD, which helps us. But if you don't have all those resources, you can go to the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation. They have a wonderful checklist that's updated as new vaccines or new recommendations become available. You can print that out, stick it in your office, and try to address some of these early on in the course of therapy.
No, I think that's a really good point, Frank. I really like that checklist from the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation. And another thing you can do is engage your patient and activate them and say, these are things that are recommended. And so maybe they could even partner with their primary care physician if you don't have access to providing these vaccines in your office. So I think any of those resources can be incredibly helpful. For those of us that have Epic, I've even dropped it into some after-visit summaries, you know, those sorts of things that can help with resources for the patients. You know, Frank, thanks so much for teaching us about all these preventive kind of recommendations for our patients. I just wanted to give you some last words in terms of some summary of what you think our listeners need to know.
Again, I think that the updated guideline really will give you all the information you need to be able to provide high quality care to our patients living with inflammatory bowel disease. Advances in therapy that over the last 10 or 15 years have dramatically improved the quality of life of our patients do come with some risk. Those risks can be managed. They can be mitigated. The risk of vaccine-preventable diseases, we can deal with it. So I think it is important that you address the importance of vaccines in our patients with IBD. At the same time, use resources like the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation to remind you to send patients to the dermatologist, to send our female patients to their primary care doctor or gynecologist for pap testing. Think about the effect of steroids on bone health and send patients. I actually do order DEXA scans on a regular basis. If the patient has osteoporosis or osteopenia, I then refer them to their primary care doctor. I had the luxury of working with a number of wonderful authors. My co-authors were Gil Melmed, Gary Lichtenstein, Ed Barnes, Berkeley Limkatai, as well as Freddie Caldera, and our senior author was Susie Kane. And so I really do think we have, I don't want to count up the number of years of experience, but an awful large number of years of experience in managing IBD. And I hope that this is readily actionable for our listeners and our gastroenterology colleagues who are caring for patients with IBD.
Well, Frank, thanks so much to you and your co-authors for this valuable document. I just want to remind our listeners that all of our guidelines are available free on our website. Please go to gi.org. Really, from the Red Journal, all of our guidelines should be at your fingertips, hopefully for use in your patients as soon as tomorrow. So thanks again, Frank, for joining us, and thanks to our listeners.
Thank you, Millie.